Welcome to the Plant-Based Canada Podcast. Join us as we talk with experts to explore the field of nutritional sciences and how our food choices impact our health and the environment. We sit down with Canadian doctors, dietitians, athletes, climate experts, and more to break down the evidence behind a whole foods plant-based diet and discuss the practical steps you can take in your effort to shift toward a healthier lifestyle.
Today's guest is Chef Ikeela Wright, the former owner of the long-standing vegan Caribbean restaurant One Love Vegetarian in Toronto. When Ikeela decided to leave the world of meat behind and enter the plant kingdom, she says her life changed. Everything she learned about cooking and the restaurant industry went totally out of the window. In the process, Ikeela not only had to learn to emphasize taste, but also to manipulate texture, timing, and temperature to create food that was pleasing to the palate without the aid of meat, dairy, eggs, or refined products. She left the restaurant industry and became a stay-at-home mother for more than 20 years, and she had a captive audience to test out her recipes, her children, who she says were her toughest critics. In between raising children and catering, Ikeela and her family became known as food vendors at many major Toronto outdoor festivals. They spent many summers vending at the Harbourfront Center, where their One Love corn soup and seasoned corn received rave reviews. This included two appearances on the Food Network, courtesy of the Christine Cushing Live Show. In 2009, with the support of her children, the One Love Vegetarian restaurant was born. One Love Vegetarian remained at the forefront of the Toronto vegetarian scene for more than a decade before shutting down in 2022 following the COVID-19 pandemic. But Ikeela is now cooking up extraordinary meals as a private chef and caterer. Ikeela, thank you so much for joining the Plant-Based Canada podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So let's get into it. Tell me first about what inspired your passion for cooking and how central was food in your household and your family when you were growing up?
Well, contrary to popular belief, not all Caribbean women can cook. So my mother was not proficient in the kitchen, let's put it like that. So that encouraged us. I had three brothers that were older, to experiment and to try to cook for ourselves as much as possible from a really young age.
What were some of the things that you were experimenting in terms of cooking when you were younger?
When I was younger, I wanted the French toast. I wanted to eat like my friends ate, the bacon and eggs, the omelets, the things that I didn't get at home because I came from a Caribbean household. My parents were both from Jamaica, and it was more Caribbean fare that they cooked in the best way they could. My father was a soldier, so he was accustomed to rations. And so he was a rough chef, like a real garrison type cook. So it wasn't pretty food. It wasn't food that really, it didn't reflect Jamaica as I began to understand as I grew in my culinary journey. They did the best they could with what they knew and how they knew how to cook.
In terms of your experience in the restaurant world, I know that you worked in the restaurant world and then you took some time with your children. And then again, when in that timeline did plant-based eating come into play? When was that a thing for you?
It came very young. You know, I was in the Caribbean. I was rebellious. I left, my mother's home. I went to explore Jamaica. And, I got involved in the Rastafari movement, which is very plant-based. Also, I was around a lot of people who were Seventh-day Adventists and people who did not eat meat for other reasons. And even at a young age, in Canada, I saw the evolution of food. I didn't drink soda since the age of 12 after that nail in the Coca-Cola experiment in science class. I said, no, I'm going to stop doing that. And my parents had a farm in Ontario. So I saw firsthand where food came from, how it should look. And I realized slowly, I didn't understand the metamorphosis, but I slowly understood that processed food wasn't good, real food, even though at that time I was not vegetarian minded whatsoever. I wanted real food. I didn't want takeout food or fast food or, food that was in a package. I wanted the real deal.
Was there any element of animal welfare that played a part for you, or was it mostly like healthy whole foods that was the attraction?
Well, being on the farm, animals become your friends. You know, I named my animals. I had three baby ducks that I raised as hatchlings when I was young, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. And I had my lammy, and I had a baby goat. And so the ethical treatment of animals, even though it wasn't called that, I mean, there's new buzzwords that have evolved over time, you know. It just, you did not treat animals badly because it just made logical sense. And for me, my evolution into becoming more plant-based also was because of logics, not because of joining any movement. It just made common sense. You can see the animals and their movements on the farm, what they do, how they eat, how they react with each other. You know, animals are very compassionate beings. They deserve to be treated well. I don't care what animal it is, whether it's a duck, a cat. I don't particularly like some animals, mice particularly, but they do deserve the rights to live and be free. Field mice are very cool. Mice in the house, not so much. So that evolution came at a young age that you know, we had dogs. You wouldn't treat your dog badly or your cat. Why would you treat a cow badly or a sheep or, you know, a chicken, you know?
And you also raised your, if I'm correct, you raised your children plant-based, right?
I did.
And how was that? So
to the chagrin of my parents, like they thought I was mad, you know, that my children are older now. So having plant-based children in that time, and, you know, not to say I was the first, there were many before me, but it wasn't as prevalent as it is now. And people thought I was nuts. You're going to make your children sick. What are they going to eat? How are you going to manage them? You know, and for the most part, like, my children have never eaten meat. Never. Yeah. And they're all adults now and they're still okay.
Are they still plant-based now as adults?
One has, you know, wandered off to the other side a little bit. He was an athlete and he was working with his protein and intake. And I even find that the way he eats, although he does eat meat, he eats very clean and he doesn't eat junk. He cooks for himself. All my children cook. All my children are very conscientious of, you know, how food is made, the trail of food. Where does it come from? How did the farmer get it to us? Who are the people that are selling it in the markets? You know, try to go to the smaller markets rather than to the bigger supermarkets when possible. Try to read labels and be aware of what you're putting in your body.
So it sounds like you were teaching them the right stuff then. You implied that
they called it child labor. They called it child labor. Because they had to help in the kitchen.
Yeah.
We had a stall and we would go to different festivals when they were young, very young. And we had our One Love corn soup and seasoned corn. So the children would have to peel potatoes. My son knew what it was to peel a 50-pound bag of potatoes. He and his sister would, you know, have competitions. How fast can you do it? You know, they would shuck corn. They would, you know, peel vegetables, cut carrots. And so when he went off to school, I remember getting a phone call from him. It was profound. And he said, "Mom, thanks so much for all those years of child labor. It's really helped me because my friends can't cook." And I thought, child labor. Really? Okay. If by any means necessary, if this is what got you to that place that you can care for yourself and use economics to buy food. When his friends were buying fast food, he was buying 10 pounds of potatoes and, 2 kilograms of rice and cooking in his dorm window. And, you know, his friends envying his lunches because they were eating from the calf and he was making big sandwiches and freezing, you know, his meats and so on, and making sandwiches that would last him for the week. Yeah, so it puts you more in touch. I think that's what I wanted for my children, to be more relative with the food rather than just grab and go, to know where it comes from, how it came about, what did you do, what did you contribute towards it being on your plate.
It's funny, I have a similar story. My parents owned a restaurant when I was a teenager, and they had it for about 7 years. And it, but it was, I was young enough to where it was before I was 16. So, but my parents would take me there, you know, summertime, and then I would work there. And in retrospect, I realized that it was labor.
Labor.
Yeah, but now I know how to cook.
Character.
Yeah,
builds character. When children aren't involved in their day-to-day lives and know what it is to contribute to the mundane things, whether it be cleaning, cooking, spreading your bed, washing your own clothes, it does them a disservice when they go out into the world. To me.
You lay some foundation there for them, for their adulthood. Tell me about what it was like, your experience in the restaurant world. I know that was your project. I don't know if you spent time in the restaurant world before that. And then having seen my parents have their restaurant, I know that it can be, you open your own restaurant. I know it can be kind of a scary venture, I guess, but I understand you had lots of help from your kids, from your friends, from your family.
Well, if I knew what I knew now, I would have been scared then. I don't think I knew enough to be scared. I've worked in small restaurants, you know, as a teenager coming up, small jobs. I lived in the Virgin Islands for a couple of years, and I started from the ground up. I raked the yard. I couldn't cook. You know, I learned from my mom, who also couldn't cook, and French toast wasn't cutting it. These were real deal restaurants that needed you to have knife skills and know how to deal with things that were appropriate for the meals that they were preparing. So I learned from cleaning fish to cutting meats and cleaning vegetables from the ground up, and that helped me a lot. And then when I was married and we decided to do our One Love and One Love corn and seasoned corn and corn soup, it was helpful. The experience I had was helpful, not just for that, for the business, but for raising my children, to know how to buy foods wholesale, how to economize on, you know, like maybe going to the reduced rack and buying dinner for tonight and making an absolutely great dinner that I wouldn't have been able to afford if I had bought it off of the regular rack. You know, trying to find tips and tricks of the trade that transferred into everyday life. And I'm sure you can appreciate that, being raised in the restaurant industry. I'm sure that when you cook at home.
It is. It's always better. And I got lucky too, because my wife is a fantastic cook. When you created your business, so you mentioned the corn soup. For listeners who might not be familiar with Afro-Caribbean cuisine, can you lay out some of the, I guess, I'm curious what some of the most popular staples are, but then also how you interpreted those or maybe created your own version of them or plant-based version of them.
I believe that everyone's vegetarian. It's just some people eat meat along with their vegetables. Hopefully they eat enough vegetables and enough ground foods. Ground foods as in yams, think root vegetables. The dishes that we served at the restaurant were like the curried chickpeas and potatoes, which doesn't have to have meat in it. Like the seasoned pumpkin, the Jamaican pumpkin, the callaloo, which doesn't have to have saltfish in it. Traditionally in Jamaica, they would add saltfish to this. Sometimes we would have ackee, but I'm a stickler for freshness, so I couldn't get it fresh. I don't like tinned things, so I wouldn't serve it in the restaurant. But if I did get the opportunity to have ackee, that would be made without saltfish. So it was just basically putting a vegan spin on Caribbean foods, you know, which can be done to any foods. You know, it's about the intention. Yeah. And I see that more and more people are taking traditional dishes from their cultures and just omitting the fish oil or omitting the fish or omitting the meat and, you know, substituting something else or not using the meat whatsoever.
I find sometimes too, it's not as hard as some people might think it is to make those substitutions. And then once you get into a groove, it's like firsthand, you know, it's so easy to just.
It becomes easier and easier. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my mother was really angry at me for not eating meat. She said, I haven't killed you all these years of cooking for you. And I thought you tried, but you didn't make it. But her ideal was that in the Caribbean, you couldn't afford a lot of meat. So you'd have like this mountain of rice and maybe yams and sweet potatoes on the side and then this coveted piece of meat that was teeter-tottering, surfing on top of the rice that with the sauce, hopefully. And that was as much meat as you could get. And so her idea was, you know, Rastafarians can't afford meat, so they don't miss it. So it's not because they don't want to eat meat, it's because they can't afford it, you know? And I think on a level, Caribbean people have had to become very resourceful with the foods from island to island, because no two islands are alike. There are similarities, but even same foods may have different names. We've had to use our ingenuity to feed our families over the centuries, over the generations. And a lot of times we've used what we can, and a lot of times that did not include meat.
What was the reaction here when you had your business to I guess what was the community reaction? Did you get a lot of support? And like you said, there's pockets of the population, I guess the Afro-Caribbean community, where at times you didn't have meat. So I guess, was that community more embracing of a plant-based restaurant?
Well, first of all, our address was 854 Bathurst Street. That traditionally was the first Caribbean grocerette in Toronto, one of the first. It was Joyce's Caribbean Food. So it was like this little hub, this HQ, where you could get Caribbean food. My parents shopped there, you know, when I was quite young. And you could get yams and plantains, you could buy patties, and they had a butcher section where you could get goat and chicken and so on, that the owner, Mr. Shuker, would wholesale and sell to the public. So when I opened there, people were like, yes, here comes curried goat again, here comes curried chicken. So some people were like, no meat, very disappointed. Yeah, and a lot of people did not, and this is 2009, a lot of people discouraged me. They said I wouldn't make it without having some flexibility. I was encouraged to have a little this and then have some veg on the side. And, you know, you can't force people to eat what you eat. And nobody is going to want Caribbean food without meat attached to it. And it's a good thing I'm very stubborn. I did not listen.
Yeah. How long was the restaurant going?
2009, and we closed our doors in 2022.
So that was quite a long time. So you had something going on there. The pandemic hit, and that was a huge thing for a lot of people's livelihoods, businesses, restaurants.
Absolutely.
You, before 2019, 2020, you had already been in the business, the restaurant business, for so long. How was that business environment evolved for restaurants in Toronto in terms of your own experience? What did you see?
Well, because we were out on the streets, I considered myself a street vendor back in the days of doing the Harborfront Center, Afrofest, Caravana, any festival. Worked on the street, the Ukrainian festival. We didn't discriminate. We went to any festival, you know, the Latino festivals, the Indian festivals, any festivals. We were there, the Korean festivals. We just were trying to get our name out there and to hustle. We were hustlers, in the positive connotation, of course. And having that kind of hustler mentality when the lockdown happened, and we felt like, you know, it was like the garrison. We had to, you know, turn the tables upside down and no chairs. People couldn't, you know, come in, don't get too close. We had to do everything takeout. So it felt very much like being in a 10 by 10 tent again. So I felt more sorry for the fine dining restaurants that weren't used to that, that were used to having the staff and the seating and the ambiance. And now they had to, you know, come down to like almost a guerrilla warfare type level of trying to get, it felt guerrilla. It felt like a zombie apocalypse. When you looked on the streets were bare. Do we close? Do we open? Did we get close to people? Do we not get close to people? And I have to say that One Love Vegetarian had some amazing customers from all aspects and all quarters of the community. Like I can't say there's one section of the community that came to One Love. We had like such a diverse set of customers, and people, you know, would call us on the phone. Are you okay? What can we do for you? People texted me, emailed me. How did you get this number? But okay, here you are. And it was scary. it was scary. And coming to the other side of it, I felt proud that we got to the other side when, you know, 2020 came, 21, end of 21, when the things started to ease up and, you know, yes, you can open your doors again. The damage had already been done, though. It was really rough. We got through a terrible storm, but then you realize that the ship has been so damaged, you can't go anywhere else. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it kind of showcases that how things work is fragile, and it doesn't take long for that stress to build up. I know a lot of restaurants. I guess you were talking about getting texts and calls. I wasn't texting or calling anybody, but I was definitely ordering from a lot of restaurants that I loved as much as I could. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily good for my health, but like trying to support the businesses. And it, like you said, sometimes it doesn't matter. It's just the damage was done.
The damage was done, but I have to say that, you know, people who I didn't even know were making contributions, like, you know, pay for the next 10 meals. I'm not coming, I can't come, but pay for the next 10 meals, please, you know? And we had a lot of that. Like, people really tried to reach out and deliberately support businesses that needed help. Uber Eats, in as much as I call, you know, the food ordering platforms the food pimps, because they do take so much off of the top, they tried during the pandemic to have, you know, stretches of time where they didn't take any kind of payment. They didn't stress any fees on the restaurants that were still open. So there was an attempt by all sectors to try and help businesses, but it was terrible. It was a terrible storm, you know. And that word, if you didn't pivot, like a lot of businesses started making frozen meal kits and, you know, make your own at home. Here's how you do it, trying to clear their inventory so their stuff didn't spoil in their fridges, or make deep sales, you know, like you can get 3 for 1 instead, you know, at high-end restaurants, you're getting like 3 for 1. It's like, what? But it almost felt, you know, like you're taking advantage of the restaurant, poor restaurant, but they were really just trying to clear their inventory and keep the few staff that they had, you know, working in the meantime.
Yeah. And nobody had a crystal ball to see how long this would last, you know.
2 weeks. They told us 2 weeks.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, you were talking about ingredients, fresh ingredients. You try to make sure that everything that you do is fresh, and then certain ingredients that you use for your cuisine. I'm curious about the push to incorporate more sustainable products in the restaurant industry. I know consumers, I guess, have been more conscious, especially younger consumers have been more conscious in recent years about making sure that they're buying from places or restaurants that are using, you know, organic ingredients or reusable takeout or other sustainable products. How did you incorporate that into your business?
Well, we bought locally in as much as possible. Some of our produce came directly from Jamaica, which was, I was very proud of that because I want to support Jamaican farmers as well. But that was very expensive because that stuff cannot be shipped. It has to be flown into the country. Where the, you know, simple things like the black takeout containers, which could not be recycled. I didn't know this at first, and we did use them initially. When I found out that they could not be recycled, although they did have the little recycling triangle on the bottom, I started using the white ones, which were quite expensive. Because our food was so juicy, saucy, it was difficult to use the bagasse board or the bamboo or the sugarcane type containers to put our food in because it would leak. There was nothing that was sustainable that was also quality enough to have the duration or the food to endure the trip from the restaurant to people's homes or wherever they were going with them. So we did make that sacrifice to make sure that the dishes that we use, the cutlery, which, you know, one box of forks that are made out of sugarcane, you can buy 4 boxes of the regular plastic forks. You know, so for a small business, what used to make me scratch my head is, why doesn't McDonald's or, you know, all these larger chains that can afford it, why don't they do it? Or why doesn't the government provide a subsidy for restaurants who are willing to do it? And it was our mandate to make sure that we were doing as much sustainable takeout containers, because we were mostly a takeout as possible. You know, this is what our food comes in. You can reuse it. We encouraged people initially to wash them and bring them back, and we can refill them for you, not to use again in the restaurant, or bring your own containers. You know, we did have an initiative with IKEA, which was pretty cool. IKEA provided some glass containers for people and thermal bags and cutlery for them to have and to use again and again. But again, with the pandemic, everyone was so scared. It was like one use and don't bring it back, please, you know, keep it. So that was difficult because of that time. But we had a lot of customers who would come to dinner, bring their plates, bring their napkins, bring their forks. And they were older and younger, all dynamics, you know, of people that were just conscious. Conscientiousness doesn't have an age limit, you know?
You make a really good point speaking about the sustainable products, but also with the pandemic. I'm sure you saw some headlines over the last couple of years that during the pandemic, when a lot of smaller businesses were struggling to make ends meet, you saw massive companies, CEOs, billionaires making record amounts of money because they were cutting corners still. And you mentioned McDonald's, you know, probably one of the biggest moneymakers, fast food restaurants there are in the world. Their meat products are subsidized and they're still using non-recyclable plastics and other, you know, and they, nobody bats an eye about McDonald's. Everybody orders it every day, but then you have smaller businesses that are trying to go out of their way to be conscious of the products that they're using that are good for the environment. And like you said, there's no incentive that, you know, they're not going to budge because they're trying to make as much money off of their product anyway, but also there's no incentive from government heads around the world. So that must be extremely frustrating, but at the same time, very commendable that you went out of your way to make sure that you were trying to do everything you could in your power to do what's right.
Well, the challenging thing also was, you know, the clientele that will go to McDonald's will not say, "Hey, Mr. McDonald's, why don't you have better containers? Why don't you have," because, you know, that's not their mindset as yet. But the customer that would come to a restaurant like One Love would be more diligent and say, "Hey, how comes your containers aren't recyclable? How comes, you know, you don't have the straws that are made out of, you know, cornstarch?" And I did get them. But these customers now, when I had to transfer the price to the food, it was very difficult. It's how do you compete with a place like Wendy's, McDonald's, Burger King, or Kentucky Fried, all of those companies that should, by moral choice, have sustainable containers, not just the brown napkins, but the real sustainable containers. And I think that the government also, with no government incentive, and also the government could enforce this to say, listen, we spend so much on climate change conferences for these guys to sit down and talk about climate change and how much money do these conferences cost. We know what's wrong. Ask the indigenous peoples of any country what's wrong. You know, like, stop the shit. Serious. Stop it. Because again, the companies and the restaurants and those smaller companies that are willing to go the extra mile cannot afford it. It's crippling. You know, and like, even, you know, like I said, to buy one box of straws that were 250, I could buy 2,000 of the regular plastic straws, but my conscience wouldn't allow me to use plastic straws, you know. And when I used paper straws, people complained, "They're so flimsy, I don't like them." Yeah, okay, bring a glass straw or take the lid off and drink, you know. I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah. But it's good that, like you said, a lot of your customers you were actually conscious. It's the idea of trying to save the ocean by not using plastic straws, but then having fish for dinner, you know?
Well, you know, have fish for dinner, but at least you're not pulling a straw out of a turtle's nose, you know? Or
yeah,
fish isn't eating microplastic. I mean, people really have to think about these things. History, it hurts my heart, because history will find us accountable for the things that we did not do, in as much as the things that we did do, but the things that we stood aside and said, "Oh man, that's really effed up." But what did you do about it? Did you stop purchasing that product? Did you stop supporting the company that still uses that product? Did you try to change your diet so that it doesn't support that? One thing with industry, government, they follow the money. If people take back their buying power and say, listen, I'm just not buying that, or I don't want to buy from a company that does this, things will change. You know, I would buy paper products, and then I realized that, wait, industrial paper is one of the greatest, you know, environmental like villains in the world. They would rather pay the fines that they have for the other products, the other products that is their main source, and then make this other product that they put out front. Look at the nice things that we're doing. We're making some bamboo napkins and we have the bamboo balls. Yes, but the mainstay of your business is killing the waterways, you know? And if I stopped buying from them and it became more expensive.
A moment ago, you mentioned a lot of the fast food restaurants like KFC and Burger King and McDonald's. I'm curious. So your business has always been plant-based, and you've been in the game for a while. I'm curious now, because you've seen also the evolution of the restaurant environment in Toronto and Canada over the last how many years? And now we're seeing this, to your point, we're seeing these bigger restaurants, these bigger franchises companies now selling Impossible Burgers or Beyond Burgers, because now there is some slight incentive for them to sell that to some people because more people are adopting plant-based or maybe flexitarian diet or whatever. I'm curious your thoughts on that, having been in the plant-based world for so long and now seeing some of these bigger franchises kind of like siphon off, I guess, and ultimately I'd rather see people having it more available, but at the same time, it's like they're just taking these products and putting them on their menu, and it's just now becoming accessible, which is good. But at the same time, it's not that the reasoning behind it being there is not as conscious as I would hope it would be.
Consciousness is not for sale.
Yeah.
Either you're conscious or you're not. Either you have a morality or you do not. So when there is a vegan menu on a restaurant's main menu, it's because of money. You know, everyone has that one vegan relative that they want to eat out with. And so they, you know, instead of giving chef a headache, let's make a vegan menu. And then it gets to a point where the vegan menu is running competition with the regular menu because so many, if it's good, that so many vegans are frequenting the restaurant. But to the point of having the meat alternatives that are not necessarily healthy, I mean, there are things that are vegan, like, you know, my tax bill is vegan. The paper, you could eat it. There's no meat or eggs or dairy in it, but is it healthy? You know, and I think that that's another level. Like, people will say, well, you know, it's baby steps. And I agree, baby steps. You can't force people to go, you know, hang their hat where they can't reach it, as, you know, as old folks would say. But at the same time, people have to know when they're being pimped and scammed. You know, if you're eating something that's full of cellulose and it's full with fillers and it's not healthy for you and it doesn't make you feel good an hour after you eat it, perhaps even though it is vegan, you know, Twinkies are vegan. Twinkies been vegan. You know, I wouldn't encourage eating Twinkies for dinner. You could eat, you know, 2-3 packs of Twinkies. No eggs, no dairy, no meat. Good for the environment? Maybe not. You know what I mean? Good for your body? Maybe not. Right? I think people have to really be more proactive and understand what they're eating. Again, you know, take your steps. And I don't judge people for what they eat. I judge people for what they don't take the time to understand and learn. There was no Google search when I was young. There was no Google University where you could go get a Google degree in anything. You know, you can find out all about plant-based and vegetarian and vegan and recipes, and you can even watch a person on YouTube making things and understand, you know, what is the process. Go look up Beyond Meat. Where is, how beyond from where? How far? Why is it impossible? You know, look into it. Are these ingredients that are good for me? And if you're cool with that, that's fine. But at least you know. You know, and I think a lot of these larger companies, it's like when I was younger, you had to go to the health store. The health food store was a journey. You had to go to the health food store to buy a liter of soya milk. It was expensive, and the only place you could get it was at the health food store. Now you can go to Loblaws. You can go to, you know, No Frills. You can go to even the smaller supermarkets that are not the high-end supermarkets, and they have a health food section. You can get gluten-free. You can, and so now what happens to the health food store? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's, yes, it's convenient because, oh, I can go grab my soy milk and get the soy, oat, almond. Like there's such a bevy of you know, of milks in the fridge. It's mind-boggling. Back in the day, you had to go to the health store, make the journey, choose which one you wanted. There was no oat. There was no half oat coconut almond. There was soy milk, or you want soy milk or you don't want soy milk. Which one? You know what I mean? There was no choice. And so what happens to that person who owned the health food store when you can now go to the health food section of the supermarket? I think it's about people's intentionality, to be intentional of where you put your dollars. You know, you can go to the produce section of the supermarket as well, or you can go to the produce market, like to one of those small green grocers that are becoming more rare. You cannot find them. I live downtown. I have to go and hunt. Where can I find a little grocerette where I can buy produce that is fresher, it's better, it's cheaper? Get away from the supermarkets, unless they're independently owned markets, and try and get out there and support where your food comes from, that is more from the wholesaler straight to the retailer, rather than having all these middlemen that there's going to be this great markup. Yes, it's more convenient, but I think if people try to buy differently, it would be better.
And I feel that I'm seeing less and less of the green grocers on the streets. There are a couple left, but you have to go out of your way to find it. Like you said, even though everything's more accessible, you can find so many soy milks in these grocery stores now. If people are trying to be conscious and they want to support these people, it's like a trek. You have to go all the way up here, or you have to travel all the way down there to get to that place to try to support that smaller business. And it's difficult. So many obstacles. Yeah.
Fast, fast, fast. Everyone wants it now. You know, I want to go grab some, you know, something for my latte. I got to run to Loblaws. I can grab it there, you know, rather than going to the smaller shop to get it. Yeah. It's challenging because we all have to live, and we all have to do what is best for us, for our families. Time is the biggest thing. And I think that's one of the things that's used against us, because everyone's in a hurry. Because if you're not in a hurry, you lose.
Yeah, exactly. Listening to you speak about this is very inspiring. And to kind of wrap things up, if somebody's listening to this and they're just starting out, or they're curious to try to transition to more of a plant-based diet, do what they can, or at least be more conscious in how they choose products. Do you have any advice in terms of somebody just starting out? Like, I know it can be overwhelming to some people, but even just, you know, like basic staples, like, oh, make sure you always have chickpeas around, make sure you always have some type of grain or green, or to get started on this, or maybe even like tips on people who are trying to be more conscious in the products that they buy, since you're knowledgeable of that as well.
There's, as you said, it's very overwhelming, especially if you're just starting out. I would say just use your common sense. Don't be an extremist. You know, I'm not a fanatic. Right? Well, maybe a little bit, but, you know, read your labels, do your research. There are search engines. I didn't have internet search engines. I didn't have that. You had to go get a book and read, you know. So I would encourage, you know, to find, like, research a good cookbook and read it like a Bible. Find out the recipes. A lot of these cookbooks have shopping lists of, you know, the items that you'll need to execute the recipes in the book that are great staples, like your beans and your legumes. And use good oil. Anything that you're going to cook, I don't care what it is, use quality ingredients. Oh, but they're so expensive. I know they're so expensive. So use less, you know, rather than going and buying canola oil. That was the other thing in the restaurant. I used sunflower oil and olive oil. I could buy like five times the amount of canola oil than the oil that I bought for the price. And when the restaurant closed, canola oil and sunflower oil were almost at par. And I thought, is this a conspiracy to make me use canola oil? Never. But it costed me. It costed me a lot. So at home, you're not cooking for a restaurant. Use high quality oil. Start there. Use really good quality oil. Use good quality seasonings. Take time and fill your seasoning cupboard slowly, slowly. There's a lot of bulk places you can buy quality seasonings. You don't have to buy it in bottles. Buy things in bulk. If you can buy with your family, like, you know, you can go and buy 16 liters of olive oil with your family and divide it in four. And then everyone can have 4 liters of olive oil, really good quality olive oil. Go to Greek Town. You can buy one of those nice big cans of olive oil. Use your wisdom, like really use your ingenuity and buy big so you don't have to buy often. Buy less often, you know, buy big things of if you're using oats or if you're using nuts, buy good quality nuts, put them in a mason jar, store them in your pantry. Don't buy small packets of stuff. It's bad for the environment, for all the packaging, and it's bad for your pocketbook because it's more expensive per pound. And work out your ratios. Like I've taught my children, you know, how much is it per 100 grams and how many, you know, how much is 100 grams into, you know, a kilogram? So how much does that work out to? You know, so if you have a larger package that it looks more expensive, but per 100 grams, it's less money, buy that one. Then you don't have to buy as often, you know. So I would say just common sense, ask questions, ask lots and lots of questions. There's no stupid questions. Use the tools that are available now. There's so much technology that will, you know, send you in good directions. Don't, you know, take everything you hear as, you know, gospel. Use your common sense. And read. Yeah. Find one or two really good books that you like. Read them from the front to the back and then again and go from there.
And the information is at so many people's fingertips now. Like you said, everyone has Google now.
Everyone's a Google PhD now. Yeah. I mean, you can get information everywhere. Just be careful and don't go too extreme. Use what the techniques that your grandmother used. Be simple. Eat simple food. Yeah. You know, and then go from there. You can make simple food be very extravagant. If you look in the high-end restaurants, it's about the plating and it's about the textures. It's not so much about the amount of ingredients. It's simple Simon stuff that they're putting on a pretty plate. You know, you can make it yourself and eat two plates.
That's true. What comes next for you? Do you are you thinking maybe a cookbook or anything in the near future?
I'm working on a cookbook. I'm also doing private catering. I'm involved in a Afro-Caribbean pop-up group, hospitality group, the Kingston Group. It's five of us as chefs who are, you know, doing small pop-ups and high-end restaurants, trying to infiltrate with Caribbean-based food. I am the vegan ambassador because they are not vegan or plant-based. So I want to represent not just Caribbean food, but vegan food wherever I go. And it's no mean feat. I've had to hoist my pots and my utensils with me into these bigger restaurants, which has been fun. Yeah, that's it. So I'm available for catering. I'm available for as a private chef, and I'm still working on the cookbook. And I'm still out here, you know, enjoying the opportunity to see other restaurants. It breaks my heart when I see restaurants that have had to close, but I'm also inspired by what's happening with restaurants that keep coming. There's so many vegan restaurants that are coming up and the food is getting better and better and better. And the, you know, I look at a place like New York City. New York has so much competition in the restaurant industry. You better come proper. It's your clothes, your toast. People don't have time for you. There's so many. So I think that Toronto is such an amazing city food-wise. I think that that elevation of food in the vegetarian world is here, it's happening, and it's exciting. You know, go out and support the vegan restaurants that are out there pushing out the good food.
Akila, it's been wonderful talking to you. I'll make sure for listeners at home that we'll post everything, your website and everything else so that people can check you out and support you. Thank you so much for joining the Plant-Based Canada podcast. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you for having this podcast because it's very important that people can find the information and have normal conversation. This isn't, you know, back in the day where it was very woo-woo and, you know, new age. This is just normal eating for normal folks that just want a good plate of food and want to nourish their families and nourish their bodies.
This podcast featured royalty-free music from bensound.com. A very special thanks to our guests for speaking with us and sharing their insights. And of course, thank you for listening. The Plant-Based Canada podcast is an initiative of the group Plant-Based Canada, which aims to educate the public and health professionals on the evidence-based benefits of plant-based whole food nutrition for individual and planetary health. To learn more about the show, visit our website, www.plantbasedcanada.org, and stay up to date by following us on Instagram and Facebook at plantbasedcanada.org and our Plant-Based Canada YouTube channel. Also, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcasts.